Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the court appearance in Manhattan today of the convicted pedophile and well-connected money manager Jeffrey Epstein, who is facing up to 45 years in prison on charges of sex trafficking of minors and conspiracy to engage in sex trafficking of minors. Adam Klasfeld, a reporter for Courthouse News Service, where his latest article is New York prosecutors charged Jeffrey Epstein with sex trafficking, joins us to discuss the appearance in court of the previously untouchable billionaire with powerful friends, including President Trump, Bill Clinton, and Prince Andrew, who was dressed in a Navy prison jumpsuit and wearing fluorescent orange sneakers as he pled not guilty. We will look into the earlier sweetheart deal negotiated by his defense attorneys, Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, that Epstein got from the U.S. attorney in Florida, now Secretary of Labor Acosta, which has since come under scrutiny and is likely to attract more attention now because Epstein's current lawyers are claiming the unusually lenient non-prosecution agreement Acosta gave Epstein would be the centerpiece of their defense against these new charges. Also, Epstein's powerful friends like Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew, who took numerous flights to Epstein's private island on his plane known as the Lolita Express, are likely to be back in the spotlight along with Donald Trump, who once described Epstein as a, quote, terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. Then we'll get a legal analysis of the jeopardy Epstein finds himself in, faced with U.S. attorneys from the Southern District of New York, including the daughter of the FBI director Trump fired, James Comey, who have a 90% success rate in prosecutions and appear to have a trove of evidence seized from Epstein's $77 million Manhattan townhouse, including lewd photos and DVDs of minors who Epstein labeled and catalogued, along with a massage table in a private room equipped with sexual paraphernalia. Eli Honig, who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and is now a legal analyst at CNN, where he has an op-ed, The Next Big Question About Jeffrey Epstein, joins us. Then finally, we will speak with Mohammed Bazzi, a journalism professor at New York University and a former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday, about his article at The Guardian, The Troubling Overlap Between Jared Kushner's Business Interests and U.S. Foreign Policy. He joins us to explore the extent to which the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has been conducting a shadow foreign policy while making financial deals on the side for his family's troubled real estate company with foreign despots and dictators eager to curry favor with the Trump administration. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Adam Klasfeld, who is a reporter for Courthouse News Service, where his latest article is New York prosecutors charged Jeffrey Epstein with sex trafficking. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Klasfeld.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Adam. And you were in court today when Jeffrey Epstein, who has, you could say he's avoided justice or dodged justice so far in the sense that a sweetheart deal was made for him down in Florida by the current Secretary of Labor, Jim Acosta, who was then the U.S. attorney in Southern District of Florida. And a lot of people were pretty outraged when they learned about that deal, and a judge even criticized the deal and tried to overturn parts of it because victims were not notified of this sweetheart deal. So a lot of anticipation, I imagine, in that courtroom today. So describe the appearance of Jeffrey Epstein, a man who has obviously had enormous amounts of money, wealthy friend, very well-connected friends, including President Trump, former President Clinton, Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, etc. What did he look like in court today in Manhattan wearing a Navy prison jumpsuit and fluorescent orange sneakers?
Absolutely. Well, you know, as you said, he was brought quite low, quite different from his usual appearance as a man of untold wealth. We do not know whether he is even a billionaire, but he was wearing a dark blue prison outfit today for a federal court and brought to face a fresh indictment over charges that, you know, as you noted, over allegations that have been around for more than a decade, but have been revealed in some more detail today. His appearance in court followed a revelation of just some of the new details that we found out that after he was arrested at Teterboro Airport, the authorities executed a search warrant on his Manhattan property. And they apparently found hundreds, if not thousands, of nude photos of women, some of whom were underage, and one of whom they confirmed with an attorney for one of the victims was underage at the time it was taken. So it was a very different appearance. One thing that was very striking about that was they executed that search warrant this past weekend, and that this stash allegedly remained in his house after this has been the talk of national attention. It speaks to someone who was not anticipating being in federal court today in a dark blue prison uniform.
So actually, in the court filings, it's made clear that Epstein knew that the girls were underage because some of the girls told him that they were like 13, 14, 15. So that's incredibly serious, is it not? Even if they testify as they're expected to do under the categories of minor victim 1, minor victim 2, and minor victim 3, they're obviously older now. Wasn't these indictments about between 2002 and 2005, right?
2002 and 2005. And it was also notable, the photographs, when they were recovered, they were also recovered with markings of where some of them were found in a safe. And if I can just pull up one of the things, one was marked on compact discs with handwritten labels, including young, with the name redacted, girl pics nude is what the bail memo said. So that would go to the point that you were making about the prosecutor's evidence of knowledge of the age of these girls.
So what was said about the facilitators, the people that Epstein hired that may well be, first of all, the division that's in the SDNY, the Southern District of New York, that's prosecuting this case is the Public Integrity Division, not the Sex Trafficking or the Sex Crimes Division. So that makes you think maybe that they're looking more towards what kind of network Epstein had. What was said about possible accomplices?
So the prosecutors seem to be playing their cards very close to their chest here. The names of the accused co-conspirators are redacted, and there's some speculation as to their identities. There were moments during the hearing where there were two proceedings today, and the second one before the district judge, Richard Berman, he asked the prosecutors point blank, will you be adding Epstein's accused co-conspirators to an indictment? And the prosecutor's response was very cautious. They said, we don't have any immediate plans, was the quote that they used, for a superseding indictment. But they didn't rule out more co-conspirators being brought up in the future. And as you mentioned, it was a public corruption unit that pursued this case, not sex crimes. This was a public corruption. So there has been a lot of speculation that given Epstein's connections, given that he was tied to two U.S. presidents and a prince, that and given that the current labor secretary, Alex Acosta, was the one who entered this sweetheart deal that a federal judge now ruled to be illegal. But the short answer that even with all of this context, we don't know where this is going. We don't know whether there will be a co-conspirator who will be added to an indictment. We just know that it's not happening imminently. and that we have from the other lawsuits, we know that he had associates, including Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite. And those names are in the mix through this kind of universe of litigation stretching from New York to Florida. But in terms of where this particular prosecution is going, we're still very much in the early stages.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Klasfeld, who is a reporter for Courthouse News Service, where his latest article is New York prosecutors charged Jeffrey Epstein with sex trafficking. You mentioned the British press tycoon Maxwell's daughter, and he, of course, Maxwell himself, disappeared mysteriously off a yacht many years back. Is the implication there, since he obviously had a preference for underage girls, she was a sort of a beard, was she? Some kind of girlfriend that gave him the cover for his real predilections?
You know, it's very interesting. Maxwell was a very key figure in one of the investigative journalism series that really made this take off. And that was a Miami Herald series, Perversion of Justice. And it goes a little bit into their relationship. In terms of what the nature of this was, we know that the indictment is talking about associates being a facilitator. And we hear this story again and again and again, both in the news reporting and the picture that becomes clear in the indictment, that there's one person who brings one of the girls in, and the massages that advance into something else that turned into a sexual assault, according to the indictment, and that these girls are paid hundreds of dollars and they are bringing in more victims. So there is that sort of chain that's involved.
And that chain may include the person referred to today in court, employee one, and also another category of victim recruiters who are taken as kind of peers of the young women, along with whatever role Ms. Maxwell played. But just getting back to what you saw today, Adam, in the court, because this is a man who seems to be above the law because of his wealth and power and his enormously powerful connections. Did you detect any kind of arrogance or any humility?
There was I have to say, he seemed entirely, but for being in a prison uniform, he seemed to react to this very calmly. And I keep going back because it's just a striking moment that here's a man who for months has been in the national spotlight for this highly controversial plea deal that has been criticized and ruled illegal by a federal judge. And as of this weekend, he allegedly has this stash of illicit, illegal, underage pornography in his Manhattan residence. It suggests a man who believed that he had a certain kind of impunity. And that appearance of a man who did have a sense of confidence was still in that courtroom.
So is that to suggest that he may cop a plea and not go to trial? Because if he goes to trial, won't that mean that his co-conspirators, in spite of the non-prosecution agreement which was made with the Southern District of Florida, that doesn't hold water with the Southern District of New York, does it? I mean, the amazing thing about that deal that he made with Acosta, who's now Labor Secretary down in Florida, was the immunity that any co-conspirators got. That's almost unheard of.
Absolutely. And that was one of the things that was so surprising about that Miami Herald investigation, that detail. In terms of will the same thing fly in the Southern District of New York, I think that you kind of answered your own question there. Absolutely not. And we saw a hint of that already. One of the things that made that Florida plea illegal was that there was not notification to the victims. That was what the federal judge ruled. What we saw here, I personally heard from one of the attorneys, David Boies, told me that the victims have been notified, that his client has been notified, that victims have been notified either by the prosecutors themselves or through other attorneys of Epstein's arrest. So we can see now that there is a very different process playing out than what played out in 2008 when that deal was struck.
And what did you make of, well, first of all, his defense lawyers, Epstein's defense lawyers, didn't they try to make the case that the non-prosecution agreement will be the basis of their defense, right?
Right, right. And what the prosecution's counter to that was that the non-prosecution agreement very specifically stated these are for crimes in the jurisdiction of the Southern District of Florida. What is happening now is the Southern District of New York, entirely different jurisdiction. The SDNY was not a party to the Florida agreement. And they're saying that the existence of this Florida non-prosecution agreement doesn't bind them. This is for things that happened in New York, that happened in an Upper East Side mansion, and that are being prosecuted here in a separate jurisdiction.
And in terms of the prosecutor, Ross Miller, I thought he had a great line, "Your Honor, this is not an individual who has left his past behind."
Right. And it's something that they mentioned in the bail, because that whether there has been any change is a huge factor in whether or not Epstein will get bail, along with does he have the ability to flee. Well, he's a man of untold wealth, his Upper East Side mansion alone, not counting his properties all around the world, is valued at $77 million. That, yes, the prosecutor did say this does not look like a man who has change, who has any kind of sense of contrition, and that the prosecutors will continue to say that when the bail proceedings shape up again next week on Monday.
So just in closing, in the last minute, the bail hearing is July the 15th, next Monday. That's going to be pretty significant, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And the position of the prosecutors in terms of the bail proceeding is that this is a man who owns property on the U.S. Virgin Islands, in Paris. He owns a private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. This is a man of untold means, two private jets, and with the ability, in their view, to flee. That if he is released, that there are no set of conditions that will allow them to bring this case forward. Of course, Jeffrey Epstein's attorneys are going to argue for some sort of mix of a bail package or monitoring, and we'll see that shape up over the next week. But the key position of the prosecution here is that if he's released on any terms, he's gone.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Adam Klasfeld.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Klasfeld, who is a reporter for Courthouse News Service, where his latest article is New York prosecutors charge Jeffrey Epstein with sex trafficking. We're going to take a brief station break and back with a legal analysis of the jeopardy Epstein finds himself in from the U.S. attorneys at the Southern District of New York.
Excuse me, mister, but is there natural oil in the sea and the pollution in the air? So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too, and you're giving mister a bad name, mister like you. So I'm taking the mister from out.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ellie Honig, who served as an assistant U.S. Attorney General in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as the director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of Attorney General for the state of New Jersey for 5 years. He's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and legal analyst for CNN, where he has an op-ed, The Next Big Question About Jeffrey Epstein. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellie.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Do you think that this person, who most people, I think, consider to be an absolutely dreadful human being, who's done the most outrageous things, and of course you can say that, you don't have to say it's alleged, because he's already pled in this sweetheart deal he got thanks to the current Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta. Do you think that the justice delayed for these young women who have been trafficked and molested and raped and abused by this man and his friends will finally see justice, not just delayed, but no longer denied?
I do think that the victims and the American public will see justice here. I think that Jeffrey Epstein is now up against all the odds are stacked against him, and I think he's going to get hammered here by the Southern District of New York. This is not the Southern District of Florida. This is not Alex Acosta, who for whatever inexplicable reason, gave Epstein a ridiculously soft non-prosecution agreement years ago. This is a whole different ballgame. The world is watching now, and I think Epstein's going to end up behind bars for a long, long time.
But Epstein's attorneys on Monday today said that in court that the non-prosecution agreement would constitute the centerpiece of their defense of him.
Yeah, well, they're wrong. The non-prosecution agreement does not bar the current prosecution in any way at all. First of all, the only thing that Epstein pled to was two state-level crimes. That has no bearing on what the federal prosecutors may do. Second of all, the non-prosecution agreement that Epstein was given only binds the Southern District of Florida out of the entire Department of Justice. That's the way these things work. It does not bind any of the other 93 U.S. attorneys' offices in DOJ, including the Southern District of New York. So I get that Epstein's defense lawyers are going to make that defense. It may be the best they have at this point, but it's not going to get them anywhere.
Well, what was extraordinary about the deal that was negotiated by Dershowitz and Ken Starr, lawyers for Epstein, and apparently they hired private investigators to harass and intimidate these young women who had been recruited and trolled in the malls by Epstein's agents. Nevertheless, the deal that they did get through the U.S. Attorney's Office down in Florida immunized all other parties. Now, that's pretty unusual. And is that immunization going to be lifted?
That immunization is completely unheard of. I've done hundreds, really probably thousands of plea agreements, of cooperation agreements, non-prosecution agreements. I've never done that. I've never even heard of that. It has no bearing. This idea that you can immunize other people around the defendant. Now, it might be binding on the Southern District of Florida, on Alex Acosta's former office, but it's not binding on anybody else. It's completely unprecedented to do a deal that way. And to me, it's one of the biggest red flags that we see here. Why on earth would Acosta or any sane prosecutor ever agree to that, unless he was really trying to go out of his way to do favors for other people who might be connected with Epstein?
Well, that's what the obvious question arises. Who's being immunized here in terms of being co-conspirators? And would that then explain why this new case is being handled by the Southern District of New York's Public Corruption Unit?
Well, the fact that the Public Corruption Unit is involved, I do think, is significant. Typically, these cases would be handled by the Sex Trafficking Unit, the Human Trafficking Unit, which is located within the Southern District in the Organized Crime Unit, which I used to be the chief of. The fact that the Public Corruption Unit is involved, they're not driving the case, but they're involved, does tell me that they expect there to be at least some public official somewhere who's somehow implicated or mentioned in the course of these proceedings. Who that may be would be pure speculation at this point, but there's been public reporting about who Epstein has hung around with in the past. So this is one of those to be determined.
Well, dare I name Donald Trump, President Clinton, Prince Andrew, the Duke of York? I mean, these are names that have been associated with Epstein in the press and widely circulated.
Sure. I mean, those are the reported names, but we won't know for sure until we either see in a trial or in some sort of court proceeding.
And again, I'm speaking with Eli Honig, who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. And he's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN, where he has an op-ed, The Next Big Question, about Jeffrey Epstein. And federal prosecutors, of course, unsealed this criminal complaint Monday today, charging Epstein. The indictment covers the time between 2002 and 2005. And the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, said in this way, I mean, he talked about this network that he created, trafficking, paying girls with cash as young as 15 to have sex with him in his Upper West Side home, which is apparently the biggest home in Manhattan. This way, Epstein created a vast network of underage girls for him to sexually exploit, often on a daily basis. It does seem that Berman is really tough on this, isn't he? I mean, he's not really playing ball with Trump, is he? He was put in there by Trump. Trump seemed to have expected some favors from him, but he's been pretty tough both on the Mike and Cohen case, the other cases involving Trump before the SDNY, and in the case of Epstein.
Well, it remains to be seen what if any, relationship Donald Trump has to this case. We know Donald Trump was friends with Jeffrey Epstein and has spoken positively about Jeffrey Epstein and has even talked a little bit about Jeffrey Epstein's preference for young women. That was a quote that the president gave many years ago. But we don't yet know if Donald Trump has any involvement in this case. I think this will be a test of the Southern District's independence. And the Southern District is famously independent. Now, we'll see how this U.S. attorney, Jeffrey Berman, does. He was actually recused off of the Michael Cohen case. So he was not part of that. But that case did indirectly implicate President Trump by naming him as Individual One and making clear that Michael Cohen had acted at the direction of Individual One. So I think if there's any prosecutor's office in the country that's perfectly positioned to handle this and to handle it based strictly on the facts and the evidence without favor to anybody, it is the Southern District of New York.
So what do you think is going to develop then, Eli Honig, in terms of these indictments naming persons referred to as employee ones, the people that procured for Epstein? They would arrange private travel by private jet from New York to Palm Beach to ensure that, quote, this is in the indictments, ensure that minor victims were available for encounters upon his arrival in Florida, and that Epstein's and his agents would pay victim recruiters, often young women, to find other, even younger women. Mm-hmm. And they were in the indictment. It doesn't name the victims, but it refers to minor victim one, minor victim two, and minor victim three. Would any of these victims testify? And do you think that the fact that the people that are prosecuting, or at least the division of Southern District of New York that are prosecuting this case, will unravel this network?
So, first of all, I do think the victims can and will testify. I've done sex trafficking trials where the bulk of our evidence was live testimony from victims and witnesses. These victims presumably now are no longer minors, so they certainly can testify. And even if they were minors, there's ways that minors can testify. We put in certain protections in place to protect their identity and their security. But yes, if this case goes to trial, I absolutely would expect to hear from these victims and perhaps others.
So what is the next stage? Obviously, not unexpectedly, the defendant, Jeffrey Epstein, pled not guilty. But when you learn about what was found in his apartment, it's pretty extraordinary. The huge cache of videotapes, DVDs of young women, all sort of painstakingly logged in with their names and whatever sexual encounter is involved with them. The massage table with all sex paraphernalia, with all there intact, as had been described by victims, etc. It does seem like they've got him pretty cold.
It does seem like that to me as well. I think the victim testimony is going to be quite powerful. I think the other evidence that they discovered today is going to be quite powerful. I would sort of speculate that they have some combination of phone records, travel records, financial records that will corroborate the victims. In terms of what happens next, the next big moment is going to happen next week. The judge scheduled for Monday, July 15th, when we'll learn whether Epstein is getting out of bail or whether he'll be locked up pending trial. That's an enormous moment in a case. If a defendant is locked up, that obviously changes the whole dynamic and his whole incentive to plead and potentially to cooperate. And I think if this defendant, if Jeffrey Epstein gets out and the Southern District is trying to keep him locked up, I think there's a real risk that he flees, given the almost unlimited resources that he has, the connections to foreign countries where he can't be extradited from, including apparently his own island. He certainly can't extradite him from there. So I think that's going to be a very important moment on Monday. I've been in front of this judge, Judge Berman, no relation to the U.S. attorney, Berman. But Judge Berman is a very good judge, a very fair judge. He will make sure the defendants get a fair trial. And he's pretty strong for the prosecution on bail. I think he's likely to deny bail and keep Epstein locked up pending trial, and we'll find that out on Monday.
Well, apparently Epstein has 3 U.S. passports, and he owns at least 2 private jets. And as you mentioned, he has a private island out of reach in the – where is it, in the British Virgin Islands?
Right. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but yeah. I know he does have this island connection.
Right. So the prosecutor, I thought, made a very strong case, you know, about denying bail.
Sure.
He finished his speech, if you will, by saying, "Your Honor, this is not an individual who has left his past behind."
Right.
If ever there was a moment of truth. So going back to the non-prosecution agreement, Eli Honig, it can't be a blanket. In other words, if you get forgiven in this ridiculous deal that current Secretary of Labor Acosta did for Epstein back in Florida, if you make those kind of deals, it doesn't immunize you against further and future crimes, surely.
Of course. No, it does not immunize you against further crimes. It does not immunize you against future crimes. It does not even immunize you in other districts. All it does is guarantee that the Southern District of Florida cannot charge him with the same conduct they already charged him with.
So what do you make of the representatives then for the 3 young women named, not named, but mentioned here in today's hearings? David Boies, representing the women, and we spoke earlier about how in the initial deal that Acosta made for Epstein, Epstein was represented by, among other lawyers, I assume, both Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz. So Boies is a bit of a heavyweight, isn't he?
Sure. All those names, I think, are generally regarded as pretty heavy hitters in the defense bar.
So what kind of a defense is he going to put on? I mean, the young women themselves would be pretty powerful, wouldn't they?
Well, I think what Epstein is going to try to do first is get out of this on the technicality. I think his lawyers will make some sort of argument that he's covered by the prior deal with Florida and the Southern District is therefore legally not entitled to bring these charges. But I think that argument will completely fail. I don't think Judge Berman will go for it. If the case comes down to a trial, I think they're going to try to attack the victims. It's really a pretty distasteful approach, but it's a common one when you have a victim-heavy case. I think they'll attack the memories of the victims. There's already been some public reporting that during the Florida case, the defense lawyers for Epstein tried to suggest that the victims had other problems or other issues. It's the job of the prosecutors to make sure these victims feel heard and feel protected and are protected and are free to give their testimony and let the jury decide who or what they believe. The other thing that prosecutors are going to do is corroborate these victims, come up with other evidence, like I said before, travel records, financial records, phone records that back up their accounts. Juries really look to that kind of proof when they're deciding whether or not they believe a witness.
So you list in your article at CNN, Eli Honig, the 3 choices Epstein faces.
Mm-hmm.
If he goes to trial, I imagine, I mean, there's a certain amount of mystery surrounding this guy. He's often described as a sort of Gatsby-esque character. Nobody's quite sure about where all the money came, since he's clearly very wealthy. But you've got even the Attorney General of the United States now, Bill Barr, saying he's going to recuse himself from anything involving the Jeffrey Epstein case because a firm that represented Epstein in South Carolina was also one that Barr joined. And ironically, Barr's father also hired Epstein to teach at the private Dalton School, despite Epstein not having a college degree. And apparently that's what got Epstein started in as a hedge fund guy. One of the wealthy parents of one of the kids at that school recognized that the math teacher, Epstein, was brilliant at math and got him into Wall Street, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, William Barr has recused himself, and I think that's a very good thing. I have very little faith in William Barr to be impartial and to be nonpartisan. I think he's shown himself through his handling of the Mueller probe and other issues that he really is not independent and he really lacks credibility. And so I think it's important, and I think it's a good move for all those who want to see justice done that he's going to be out of this case.
But if there are very powerful people that could be named, do you think there'd be pressure on Epstein not to go to public trial? to Copperplay?
Sure. I think his lawyers are aware, and he's well aware, that the one way for sure that everybody gets named in public is if he goes to trial. And I think that's one of the factors that goes into a calculation about whether to go to trial, to plead guilty, or to try to cooperate. So, yes, if this goes to trial, we're going to learn everything. We're going to hear names. We're going to learn who did what and who was part of this in any way.
Well, just in closing, another irony, of course, in this case is that the daughter of the former director of the FBI, James Comey, is one of the prosecutors in the Epstein case with the Southern District of New York.
Yeah.
So life is rather strange, is it not?
Yeah, I don't know her personally, but I do know plenty of people who worked with her and know her. And from everything I've heard, she is a very good prosecutor, straight down the middle, plays it straight as any prosecutor should. And I do hope that we don't get into nonsense conspiracy theories here about because of her relation to James Comey. I mean, it takes about five leaps of logic to get anywhere with that. So I hope that doesn't get wings.
Well, I wouldn't count on that, Eli Honig. I think the deep staters out there will jump on that one right away.
I have a sense they might.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Eli Honig, who served as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. He's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN, where he has an op-ed, The Next Big Question, about Jeffrey Epstein. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the troubling overlap between Jared Kushner's business interests and U.S. foreign policy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mohammed Bazzi, who is a journalism professor at New York University and a former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday. He's writing a book on the proxy wars between Saudi Arabia and Iran and has an article at The Guardian, The Troubling Overlap Between Jared Kushner's Business Interests and U.S. Foreign Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mohammed Bazzi.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, Jared Kushner started out, even before Trump's inauguration, making deals. According to intercepts from the NSA, I think it was December the 10th or 12th of 2016, shortly after the election, that Kushner met with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, and the head of VNB Bank, which is often referred to as Putin's slush fund, at which he apparently asked for two things. One is a back channel between the Trump White House and the Kremlin, which is an extraordinary thing in itself. But he also apparently asked the VNB banker for $500 million to bail out 666 Fifth Avenue. And because when they reported back, the diplomat and the banker reported back to Moscow, apparently the NSA intercepts indicated their dismay at the chutzpah of this fellow asking for that kind of money. So this surely is not a surprise, given the track record that he's been shaking down foreign potentates ever since he's been in the office. But how come at this point he's gotten away with it?
Well, I think part of it is the audacity of what he's done since he's been in his position, and certainly since Trump has been in office. I think that's one factor. Many people have become desensitized to the level of corruption and the scope of what we've seen. I mean, on that Fifth Avenue tower, the 666 Fifth Avenue, you know, we've now seen a long track record of Kushner and his relatives, his father and others involved in Kushner companies over the years, starting around 2015 into 2016 and then continuing into the Trump administration, approaching investors from China, from Qatar, from other countries, but especially focusing in on these investors who had ties to the Chinese and Qatari governments, and speeding up and accelerating their approaches to those investors trying to bail out that property after Trump was elected. Now, Kushner insists that he no longer had anything to do with those negotiations because he divested himself. He sold his stake in the building in that office tower after he took his job in the Trump administration. He sold the stake to a family trust. But of course, he still has a large holding, a large stake in the Kushner companies themselves and in those holdings. And we don't know very much about the extent of what else he controls in that company. And sort of one picture we've gotten, one slice of the picture we've gotten has been from the government disclosure reports. And the latest ones from last year show somewhere around $800 million that Kushner's stake in his own family firm and his other real estate holdings and other holdings combined with Ivanka Trump's holdings, they total up to around $800 million. But we don't know if that's a full picture of all of his business interests. And those disclosure forms also don't provide enough detail on all of the ways that Kushner and his family are enmeshed with foreign investors and foreign groups and foreign governments.
So could it be, Mohammad Bazzi, that Ivanka and her husband Jared are wealthier than Trump ever was? I mean, we know that he's claims to be worth about $10 billion, but Bannon, who's been the source for Michael Wolff's latest book, Siege, says that at best Trump's been worth about $50 million or $100 million, and not $10 billion. So if that is accurate, then the scions of the Trump dynasty are doing pretty well, right?
Yeah, if that's accurate. I haven't done any reporting or research on that aspect of it, but it is possible that Kushner and Ivanka's combined wealth or combined holdings could actually be larger than Trump's. I mean, I think one picture that emerged over the years is that Ivanka was quite effective at licensing the Trump Corporation's names and making some of those deals that help get foreign money into the Trump Organization's coffers by negotiating deals to sell the name and to get investors to buy that Trump name and to open up resorts and golf courses and towers in different countries. So, yeah, it's very possible that she's a better businesswoman than her father, and that Kushner has been a better businessman than his father.
And again, I'm speaking with Mohammad Bazzi, who's a journalism professor at New York University and a former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday. He's writing a book on the proxy wars between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and he has an article at The Guardian, The Troubling Overlap Between Jared Kushner's Business Interests and U.S. Foreign Policy. Just back to the Michael Wolff book, for whom the main source appears to be Steve Bannon, who was also the source for his earlier book, Fire and Fury, which was largely why Bannon got fired, because of the stuff that he was saying in the book. So it's hard to know how much of the book to take seriously, but one of the things in it that caught my attention seemed to make sense, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, Mohammad, that what Bannon was saying was what Kushner and Trump offered to all of these despots and kleptocrats around the world who are anxious to do business with the United States government. However, they run up against roadblocks with the State Department, the Defense Department, and other agencies because of their criminality, etc. And what Kushner essentially did was he hung up a shingle saying, we're open for business with all you kleptocrats and crooks and despots around the world, whether it's Erdogan, Putin, Mohammed bin Salman, you name it. You don't have to deal with the United States government. You can deal directly with us. Have you had any inkling of that as well?
It's some inkling of that. Let me share a story that I've heard and I've tracked down a bit in the past few months, which is, sort of that even before Trump took office, Saudi Arabia's leaders, and especially Mohammed bin Salman, figured out that they could target and influence Kushner, particularly Kushner, because of his lack of knowledge about the Middle East, his enthusiasm to try to negotiate this so-called deal of the century between Israel and the Palestinians, and also his business dealings and his exposure in business dealings. And so in November of 2016, after the election, Mohammed bin Salman sent a delegation of Saudi officials to the U.S. to meet with Kushner and other Trump advisors and high-level advisors who would be coming into the administration. And the members of that Saudi delegation wrote, I think, a prescient assessment of Kushner and of the Trump administration, and that assessment was leaked later to a Lebanese newspaper, a newspaper called Al-Akhbar. And in that assessment, they wrote that Trump, quote, his inner circle is predominantly dealmakers who lack familiarity with political customs and deep institutions, and they support Jared Kushner. So even back then, in the earliest days, that delegation, that Saudi delegation, read Kushner correctly, that he's exposed, that he's vulnerable to manipulation. And I think it continued from there. We saw in early 2018, the Washington Post reported that U.S. intelligence officials were worried that there were officials in at least four countries, the UAE, Israel, Mexico, and China, had discussed ways to manipulate Kushner. And these U.S. officials had been worried that Kushner was naive and was being tricked in his various contacts with foreign leaders. These leaders tried to take advantage of his business arrangements and his lack of foreign policy experience. In a lot of ways, a lot of this can also apply to Trump. And I think you're largely right that Trump and Kushner put out this idea that leaders, and especially leaders who want to make deals, can go directly to them. And we've now seen quite a bit of evidence that these dictators and leaders wanted to deal directly with Kushner and with Trump if they could, but they wanted to bypass Rex Tillerson and pretty much everyone else in the cabinet and just go to Kushner because they figured out that he could be manipulated.
Well, this has been verified, has it not, by Tillerson himself, who recently testified before the House in closed session before the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And apparently from transcripts that were leaked, he basically said that, you know, he went to a fancy restaurant in Washington, D.C. and ran into Kushner and Mexico's foreign minister. And you mentioned those four countries, one of which was Mexico, sort of huddled in the corner. And of course, the Mexican foreign minister's face went ashen when he saw the Secretary of State Tillerson there. And Tillerson apparently rather curtly said, next time you're in town, give me a call. So he was clearly peeved, right? So there's evidence, is there not, at least on one of those four countries, that Kushner was in fact conducting a shadow foreign policy.
There is, and that was a remarkable part of that interview by Tillerson, where he recounted that experience. And another great tidbit from that transcript is this meeting in May of 2017, which, and this was the Democratic staffers and lawyers who were interviewing Tillerson at that closed session. They told them about this dinner that took place in May of 2017 between Kushner, Bannon, and top leaders of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And according to these congressional staffers who seem to have done some work tracking this down, Kushner and Bannon were told about the plan by Saudi Arabia and the UAE to impose a blockade on another U.S. ally, on Qatar, at that dinner. And Tillerson and Jim Mattis and sort of everyone else in the administration seems to have been left in the dark at that point. And so this was several weeks before the blockade was imposed. So if this is accurate, and it seems to be that the Democratic staffers who interviewed Tillerson were confident in it, then Kushner and to a lesser extent Bannon were running this shadow foreign policy, completely circumventing Tillerson, Mattis, and others in the administration.
But didn't this also, this blockade happen, a couple of weeks after Kushner met privately with Mohammed bin Salman?
It did, yes, and that's then. There's been speculation and some reporting and some intercepts around whether bin Salman had revealed his intentions to Kushner at that point. The blockade also took place a couple of weeks, or about a month, after this ill-fated meeting between Charles Kushner, Jared's father, and others from Kushner companies with the Qatari finance minister. And at that meeting, they asked for financing to bail out their office tower at 666 Fifth Avenue, and they were denied. Now, Kushner, Jared himself wasn't at that meeting, but his family was involved. And weeks later, he seems to have been at this dinner and possibly the dinner in Riyadh with Steve Bannon, and then possibly also his meetings with MBS, where he learned about the blockade and seemingly didn't do anything about it and didn't alert other members of the administration. Certainly, we now know, thanks to Tillerson's testimony, that Tillerson and Mattis were left in the dark about this until the day it happened.
And apparently Trump didn't even know that the biggest U.S. base was in Qatar.
Yes, yes, that's one of those important facts that Trump, and we're getting used to the idea that Trump is deficient in knowing very important facts. And one of the back stories behind that is that the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, wanted that base for years, and instead Qatar was able to secure that base, to secure the largest U.S. base in the region. And there's been ill will from the UAE toward Qatar for years now over the location of that base and the fact that Qatar was able to set it up and build it and get the U.S. to base its presence there.
Well, it seems like a coincidence, doesn't it, that the Kushners get turned down. They're asking for $500 million, but starting with the Russians, then with the Chinese, and then with the Qataris. And when they get turned down by the Qataris, it seems like out of spite, Kushner joined with the Saudis and probably gave them the green light, being the shadow foreign minister or secretary of state, blindsided both Tillerson and Mattis. And Trump, of course, tweeted his support for the blockade of Qatar. And it seems to me that the real agenda, particularly from the Saudi point of view, why they went after Qatar, they said it was to do with their support for the Muslim Brotherhood. But isn't the thing that really drives the Saudi royals crazy is Al Jazeera? They really want that shut down, don't they?
They do. The Saudi royal family is really driven crazy by Al Jazeera, as is the UAE to a lesser extent, as are a lot of the despots and dictators in the Middle East. But Al Jazeera is definitely one of those institutions that they hate, and they also, the Saudis and the UAE, really hate the fact that Qatar was pursuing its own foreign policy in the region, supporting Muslim Brotherhood branches in different parts of the region, and also through Al Jazeera, which gave Qatar much wider reach in the region because it's such a popular network. And the Saudis and the UAE haven't been able to replicate anything similar. They've funded their own TV networks and their own satellite channels, and they haven't had the same level of success that Al Jazeera has had. But definitely closing Al Jazeera has been one of the main demands that Saudi and the UAE have imposed on Qatar. But so far, we're 2 years into the blockade, and Qatar has been able to withstand it. It's actually had the opposite effect that it was intended. Qatar now seems more self-reliant by having connections with Turkey, with Iran, with other countries that are helping it bypass the blockade. And if the Saudis and the UAE were hoping that it would turn Qatar away from Iran or from Turkey, it's had the opposite effect. And for now, at least, Trump seems to kind of taking more middle of the road approach to it. He's expressed more support to Qatar, and it's just one of those things that's become a self-inflicted wound by the Saudis and the UAE.
Well, just in closing, in the last couple of minutes here, does that have something to do with the fact that eventually the Qataris, who are the second largest investors in Brookfield Asset Management, who were the group, Canadian group, that bailed out 666 Fifth Avenue. So the sort of worm has turned, or the circle is closed now, hasn't it? And Brookfield Asset Management also own Westinghouse Nuclear. And there were discussions with the Saudis about selling Westinghouse Nuclear, selling nuclear reactors to the Saudis, which was all done in secret to the absolute shock of the House and Senate.
Yes, we've now seen that the Kushner family eventually found a savior for that Manhattan office tower, and it is Brookfield Asset Management, and the second largest investor in the real estate subsidiary happens to be Qatar's sovereign wealth fund. So eventually, Qatar has, in an indirect way, ended up helping bail out Kushner companies from that office tower. And then there is, as you mentioned, this even more complicated arrangement where Brookfield was trying to take over Westinghouse Electric, which needed Trump administration. So it needed the Trump administration approval for that. A lot of that happened last summer as Brookfield was closing its deal on the office tower. Another subsidiary was receiving approval from the Trump administration to be able to take over this bankrupt nuclear services company that's in line to do business with Saudi Arabia, you know, over time, and could actually get a very lucrative nuclear power contract with the Saudis. And so this office tower and the Kushner company's interests at the heart of two very shady sets of deals and operations in the Middle East that sort of have involved the Trump administration.
Well, Mohammed Bouazizi, I thank you for joining us, and we should follow this story, and I know you will, so I'd like to catch up with you again, and I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mohammed Bouazizi, who's a journalism professor at New York University and a former Middle East bureau chief at Newsday. He's writing a book on the proxy wars between Saudi Arabia and Iran and has an article at The Guardian, The Troubling Overlap Between Jared Kushner's Business Interests and U.S. Foreign Policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.